Simon Winchester is the best-selling author of The Professor and the Madman, Krakatoa, and A Crack in the Edge of the World. In his new memoir, he has for the first time told the story of his irregular bouts of madness as a young man, a series of terrifying 9-day spells in which he lost recognition of much of his surroundings, putting his life and others in danger. A definitive diagnosis was never made and no treatment worked until the controversial technique of electroshock therapy finally seemed to break the pattern. His new memoir, which is being published by Byliner in an e-original, is entitled The Man with the Electrified Brain. It locates the finest of lines between sanity and insanity, and certainly is his most personal work to date. It's a great pleasure to welcome our good friend Simon Winchester to the program. Thank you very much for being here. A delight.
Thank you, Joe.
I have to say that this, I found this all very surprising, reading this. I did not know that this was a part of your life and in you, having known you for a very long time. At what point did you decide that you wanted to share this with the world?
My parents both died last year, or actually my mother just a little before in the year prior to that. And they had always inculcated in me, as many Britons of their generation did, a sort of pull yourself together. You know, if you feel a bit depressed or in some way sort of mentally afflicted, go out and dig the garden. You know, that was their cure. And this was a very a British way of looking at things. I mean, I compare it to other people of my generation, that they didn't go along with the American view of psychiatrists and being a bit sort of whiny and going bleating to your doctor every time you got a bit depressed. And I think that really instilled in me a reluctance to talk about this. My parents never really accepted that I had been ill when I was in my early 20s, when all this occurred. And if it went away, well, they were relieved and put it all down to my imagination. But once they had passed away, by coincidence, an editor friend of mine in New York said she had heard that I'd been unwell when I was a youngster. Would I ever like to write about it? And I said, well, you know, actually, I think I would, because, I mean, I don't like to use the word closure. It never didn't bring closure to me, but it did enable me to talk about a much stigmatized form of treatment, which I actually think for some people can be very helpful indeed. And so that was partly, so two reasons, really, to answer your question. One, a new freedom coming out of the passing of my parents, and this keen desire to get some dialogue going about a very controversial form of treatment.
You were a geology student at Oxford. You were in your second year, and this was really a night and day sort of event where you went to bed one night and everything was fine and woke up and everything wasn't.
It was quite extraordinary, and I remember it so vividly. I was preparing, you're quite right, it was the end of the summer term, or semester, as you say here, of my second year, and we were going, a bunch of us, six of us, to East Greenland on a geological expedition. And I'd been preparing for that and also doing my academic work. And on this particular night, it was a Friday night, I'd been writing an essay, coincidentally, about a geological formation in Greenland. And was writing, it was a June evening, so it was very light. I wrote until 10, and then I switched on the light and wrote on till 11 at midnight and heard all the Oxford clocks chiming midnight, and then 1 o'clock, and then 2 o'clock. And at 2 o'clock, I finished the essay. And I then went upstairs and brushed my teeth and all that sort of thing and got into my pajamas and went to bed and picked up a copy of a paperback book that I had bought that very day in Blackwell's, which is the big Oxford bookstore, of Human Bondage by Somerset Maugham. And I read it to page 32, and I'll never forget that, put a bookmark in page 32, put it on the floor, turned over and went to sleep. And in the morning, everything had changed. I just felt so strange. I mean, it's still at this remove, although I say it, I remember it vividly, it's very difficult to explain how everything seemed so odd. But things like my robe on the back of the door, my pile of clothes, a pile of books, everything looked weird and threatening in a way. I had a cheap print of the Van Gogh painting known as the Bridge of Arles, or the Bridge at Arles. And somehow the bridge looked strangely fragile, as if it was going to fall down. The two cypress trees on either side of it looked like swirls of smoke. They didn't look like trees. A cloud looked like a smear of cream cheese on the canvas. I know it sounds bizarre, but it was as if I looked at everything in incredible details in what we now would say a sort of pixelated way, and the pixels made no sense at all. I remember turning over and looking at this book of human bondage and thinking, what, Somerset? I mean, who would call his child Somerset? And A-G-E, and what a weird suffix for a word. And I went upstairs sort of bewildered and no one in the house, so I was sort of frightened by that. Went back to bed for 10 minutes, got up again, and found that the clocks were all wrong. They all said 4 o'clock. And then I realized that they were right, and I had slept not for 10 minutes, but for 8 hours. And then I remembered vaguely that I was due to do something to do with the expedition, which was to pick up a van which was nearby, maybe a mile or so from my little flat. And I dressed, although I must have looked dishevelled and unshaven, and everyone out in the street seemed hostile and bumping into me. And I found the van eventually, had no idea how to drive it, had lost all sort of, and then sat in it thinking, oh my God, the world is going mad. Eventually worked out how to drive it, set off, and crashed it within 10 minutes, and it was steaming and dripping oil. And I left it against the bollard I had crashed into. I hadn't hurt anybody, thank heavens, and stumbled back to my apartment and went to sleep and didn't wake up until Tuesday. I mean, I slept 72 hours nonstop. And that episode, it gradually then when I woke up, somehow the picture seemed a little less insane and things started to seem a bit more comprehensible. And then it went away. And I thought, well, that was weird. It'll never come back. But the problem was it did come back. And then it kept coming back at recurrent intervals of about every 2 or 3 weeks. And it always lasted, as you mentioned, for exactly 9 days. And I was at my wit's end. And then it unfolded for the next 4 years.
You talk about not knowing how to drive and different things, and the terms that you use in the book are folded in the dirt and slumped into a chasm, and these to explain the detachment that you have. Did you know who you were?
Well, that's a very good question. I certainly challenged who I was. Nothing seemed stable. I mean, Oxford didn't seem Oxford. Greenland, when I got there, didn't seem... Well, I'd never been to Greenland before, but it seemed ultra weird. And I think it's a very good question. I don't think I did know who I was. I had no sense of my self-identity. It was as if I was detached from myself and watching someone's life in a movie, but a movie that was, you know, made by David Lynch, I would say today. It was all very, very strange. And yet there was a period, there was one nearly a year, when I actually, I managed to graduate from Oxford. I got a moderate degree. I took a job as a geologist in Uganda, in East Africa. And during that period, I had none of these illnesses at all. But the moment I came back to England, because it was a completely different story, but I decided to become a journalist and leave geology for good, these episodes started coming back with a terrible regularity. But during that period, I was married and had a child, and I had this new job as a reporter, but with these constant interruptions. And how I kept that job, I don't know, except I had an extremely, extremely, a wonderfully supportive wife and a very, very tolerant editor who said, well, journalists are sort of mad people. So just as long as when you're sane, you do good work, we'll let you get better.
It seems after the first incident that most of us would go and seek a diagnosis immediately.
Well, I think this goes back to my parents. I mean, when I was in that state, I was in no state to go anywhere. If I had someone looking after me, but I wasn't. I was on my own at university, and my friends, I didn't want to see them, and I was just very quiet, and I was asleep most of the time. So I didn't have the wherewithal to go up and see a doctor. Moreover, I had never seen a doctor, so I didn't have one in Oxford. I think there was a sort of medical officer to the university, but I never troubled him. Then the next episode, I was in Greenland, thousands of miles from a doctor. I mean, you can consult a polar bear or something, but that was about all. And it wasn't for years until my wife then said, you better go and see a doctor. And they were a bit mystified, and all they said was, oh, well, you're depressed. You know, and I was depressed because I didn't know what was wrong with me, and that was why I was depressed. So they gave me these tricyclic antidepressants, tofranil and triptazole, and all they did was they made, you know, my mouth very dry, and I shook my hands a lot, and I became even more depressed because I thought, well, whatever medicines these doctors are giving me clearly aren't working. And the episodes kept coming back. So, yes, I was depressed, but that wasn't what was wrong with me.
At the point where you went to, before you went to the doctor and before you went to seek a diagnosis, I would think that the scariest part of it was not knowing when it was going to hit again, that it could be this moment, it could be today, or it could be 2 weeks from now.
Well, the funny thing is, Joe, that even to this day, because I'm so haunted by waking up and finding myself in this state, that even today, I mean, I'm still working as a journalist and writer, and I go to some pretty unfamiliar places, and I bed down for the night, and I wake up, and I'm sure we've all had this experience. You think, where am I? And, you know, if I open the curtains, what will I see? Will it be Knoxville, or will it be Kabul, or will it be where I live in Sandersfield? And during that moment of uncertainty, I have this additional uncertainty from a couple of seconds. Has this come back? And it never has, thank heavens. But for years afterwards, that was quite an intense fear. Now, at this remove of half a century, I'm pretty sure it'll never come back. But it was, the uncertainty was dreadful.
Before we talk about the treatment and what led you to that, I'm curious as to, as time went on through that 4 years and these 9-day episodes would repeat themselves, and as you say, with more regularity, did you get almost used to feeling that way? Or was it always a shock to the system?
It was always terrifying. No, I never became used to it. I can see the point of your question, but no, it wasn't like putting it on an old shoe or something. Oh, it's come back again. No, it was horrifying because each one, in a way, was a little worse than the previous one. It sort of added, there's this Greek phrase, heaping pelion upon ossa. It made something worse every time it happened.
The story that you tell in the book is that of ultimately seeking treatment and how you ultimately came to electroshock therapy was very random.
Extraordinarily random. I mean, I was in one of these episodes. I lived at the time, my first newspaper job was in Newcastle upon Tyne, which is in the northeast of England. And if you go westwards across Hadrian's Wall, the famous, you know, Roman wall to keep out the Picts, on the other side of the wall is a town called Carlisle. And I had, or my wife had, an aunt there. And we went to see her. She thought it might cheer me up. So we get into my little car and I drove, although goodness knows how I managed, but my wife sitting beside me and a little boy in the back. And we drove. It was a beautiful spring day and drove just beside Hadrian's Wall, which, you know, a piece of incredible tourism had I been a tourist. But of course, to me, everything was bleak and grim and miserable. Get to Carlisle, where I had this elderly aunt who had two West Highland Terriers and a litany of imagined illnesses. And she had a doctor who came every day to treat her. I mean, more as a sort of conceit, really. She wasn't at all ill, as far as I could see, and lived on to be nearly 100. Anyway, the following morning, I was sitting just sort of staring out of a window and looking miserable as sin. And this elderly doctor came, and I heard him talking to my aunt and then to my wife, and they were talking about me because he was clearly saying, what's wrong with that fellow? And then he seemed to realize, he was an elderly man, and he came over to me and put this comforting hand on my shoulder and said, I know what's wrong with you, and I know how we can fix you. Don't worry, it'll soon be over. And an ambulance came, and with sort of the cliched burly men in white coats, and I was taken away to a hospital which I'd never been to before, called Garland's Hospital. But I remember, as I was driven through the gates and seeing this sign saying Garland's asylum, which is what it was, that we, reporters on the newspaper I had worked for, had written stories about the mistreatment of elderly patients by the nurses in the hospital, the male nurses in the hospital. And I thought, my God, I'm not only am I feeling afflicted by this weird illness and I'm really depressed, but I'm now being driven against my will, because this was a compulsory, into a hospital where they beat people up. And I was led into a room, and my wife, she's no longer my wife, but we still talk, and she said it was one of the most difficult decisions of her life, because she had to sign a piece of paper assigning me forcibly to this place and to whatever treatment I was going to be subjected. And I was strapped down to a table, big leather straps with brass buckles, and there was some, it looks rather like the studio, lots of equipment, you know, electronic mysterious stuff. And then they gave me an injection, and then this strange doctor came in with, I just remember he had sort of olive skin and very piercing blue eyes. And he said, we're going to give you some electric shocks. And they put some unguent on my temples and put some electrodes on it. And then they turned up a knob and pressed a switch. And suddenly everything went very strange. And there was this buzzing noise, which got louder and louder and louder. And then I obviously became unconscious. And then I woke up in a completely different room with two or three very unfamiliar people sitting at the foot of the bed. And I had this splitting headache and no idea where I was. But slowly, sort of like the evaporation of a morning fog, I realized that these people were my wife and her sister and my aunt. And then as I remembered them, I slowly sort of swam back into reality. It still felt strange. But then I had, over the next 6 weeks, six more such sessions of what they now call ECT or electroconvulsive therapy. And I might say that convulsive, because you jerk around like a sort of fish on a slab when you're in this, when you're being electrified, and hence the leather straps, and you get terrible bruising from them. So around your chest and your wrist and your ankles, you have welts, very painful. But after six of these sessions, totally cured. Never, never did it come back.
Simon Winchester is our guest. His new ebook, which is a memoir, is entitled The Man with the Electrified Brain: Adventures in Madness. We'll continue our conversation with Simon Winchester after this short break.